And welcome back to the Crunch, folks. How you doing? 7:02 Eastern Time, 4:02 Pacific Time. And somewhere around the world, it's 02 if you're tuning in as well. I'm your host, Nick LaPenna, and this is the Crunch, biggest sports talk at the university. Now, I want to say something right now. Boy, was that a boring Super Bowl. Likely the most boring Super Bowl in history. I'm going to break that down as well before transitioning into the breaking news of the Austin Matthews new deal with the Leafs. 5 years, $11.6 million a year. I'll break down, along with analyst Evan Preto, how that will shape up the Toronto Maple Leafs for the near future. I'm then going to break down the NBA trade talk, specifically the Raptors, a huge, huge proposed deal coming out of the Raptors camp today. I'm going to break down whether it is a smart move by Masai Ujiri to ask Memphis for a couple of their aging stars. And then I'll finish up by just giving credit to Ricky Fowler. He wins the Waste Management Open down in Arizona, And as someone who's been a Ricky hater for a while, you'll be able to attest to that as online we post old shows. I've gone over why I don't like Ricky Fowler, and I'll remind viewers why I don't, but credit where credit is due. He backed into the final round at 20 under par, pretty good. He then scored 3 over par, but still held on to win by 17 under. I'll break that down as well. But folks, stick around after this short commercial message. This is The Crunch on the Radio Laurier Network.
Full blast the other way. Fires! Score! Fantastic work at both ends of the rink, and the Caps win.
Here come the Leafs. It's their turn to center Austin Matthews with Connor Brown. In on to Kaiser. Gardner comes up late. His pass side of the net. Matthews backhander. Scores!
Pick from Bosch. Wade turns the corner behind his back. Bosch for the lead. Got it. 5 tenths left. Bosch.
And we're back on the Crunch here. Super Bowl Sunday. Always entertaining. Always one of those nights of the year I really do look forward to for a variety of reasons. You know, I'll usually catch up with some buddies that I haven't seen in a while. I'll order a ton of wings, ton of pizza. I'll get a lot of bets going. That's probably the day that I bet the most out of any day. And, you know, this year was a bit of a letdown. I'm going to be honest. And it's not just because of the game. It started, I'll just repeat this quickly because I have mentioned it many times already, but it started with the blown call against the Saints. The Rams end up moving on to the Super Bowl, and right away it all feels illegitimate, doesn't feel right, and it's not aided by the fact that it took over a week for Roger Goodell, commissioner of the NFL, to come on and publicly state that they made a mistake, that the officials were human. Again, there's a difference between being human and making the odd mistake here and there and missing an egregious call where Tommy Lee Lewis gets probably concussed. We didn't have official reviews after that, but he just got pounded in the head, and the ball wasn't even close to him. So that kind of set the mood off. And then it didn't get any better because then the Patriots won. And look, I like Brady. I've said it multiple times. Greatest quarterback of all time. There's two people you do not bet against. Floyd Money Mayweather Jr. in boxing and Thomas Edward Patrick Brady of the NFL. 6th ring. But frankly, a lot of people don't like him or the Patriots. Obviously, there was the cheating scandal a couple years ago, Deflategate, and he was suspended 4 games for that. And look, it was one of those lose-lose scenarios for the NFL. You have the illegitimate team from LA making it, and yet again, the Patriots making it. So for the casual fan, not the ideal scenario, and the ratings really sent a message on that front. Lowest in a decade, 98 million viewers, still high on the CBS telecast, but it was 5 million less than last year. And let's talk about the game now. Frankly, it lacked excitement. Pats win 13-3 over the Rams. Edelman, the MVP with 141 receiving yards on 10 catches. He was pretty good. I mean, he really sliced and diced up the middle. And what's more impressive is the fact that it's not like New England really had another threat. I'll talk about Gronk in a second. But he was doing it on one-on-one and even double coverage. He was just a quick little lumberjack because he's got the massive beard. You know, he's a polite guy, a little gruff, doesn't say much, but he'll burn you, man. He is small and he will burn you. And that's what he did. Tom kept finding him in the open flank. And Gronk, I mean, I called it last week. You can go back to RadioLaurier.com/the-crunch-2. That's RadioLaurier.com/the-crunch-2. They're going to upload the previous week's episode about a week later, so you should see that either up now or tonight. But the point is that he was the ace in the hole, like I had said. And look, he's been injured a ton. He's probably retiring after this game, but he was their ace in the hole, man. And he came out in that second half and caught a few huge balls, 87 yards on 6 catches, especially on that game-winning drive. And look, the game was 3-3 heading into the fourth. Who are you going to put your money on? Seriously. You're going to bet against Tom Brady? Absolutely not. He leads the drive all the way. A huge pass, 29-yarder to Gronk. You know, Tom thread the needle. And props to Gronk. He laid out and snagged that ball before it touched the ground, setting it up at the 2. And Sony Michel punched it in, who also had 94 yards on 18 carries. But Gronk was the ace in the hole, man. He's injured. He's hurt. He's a shell of what he was. But when they needed him most, in that second half, they started giving him legit routes and legit plays. And he came through. And he really made the difference, I found, once Edelman, by the second half, had garnered a ton of the pressure. Because remember, in the second half, he only had 3 catches. I mean, his impact was not the same in the second half as it was in the first. And granted, you know, there was a missed field goal by the Patriots early. It should have been 16-3, but it just was a tough day offensively for both teams. But I have to give credit, first and foremost, to the Patriots defense. It was just tremendous. Belichick drew up a tremendous game plan. He kept putting 7 guys at the line of scrimmage to fake out Goff, the Rams QB, who was thinking blitz. And he would just give an array of pressure that were only 4 or 5 guys. And he'd bring that safety around. It wasn't in the middle near the back, like as per usual. They just had different types of zones that really threw off a young quarterback like Jared Goff. So it was frankly pretty impressive on that front, and it worked. Hightower had a couple sacks. He was a monster in terms of getting to the quarterback, creating pressure. That whole D-line for the Patriots did well, but Hightower stood out. And Gilmore, he broke up, I think, a half dozen balls, long balls mostly to Cooks and Reynolds. He was great, and of course, he had that game-sealing interception with about 1.5 minutes left that really ended the game. So those were the 2 standouts defensively, but a tremendous game plan by the Patriots. They came and they executed, right? It wasn't like last year. It was polar opposite, where Tom Brady set the passing yards record in a Super Bowl, over 500 yards. This, he had to really muscle it out because that Rams D-line was pretty good too, but they did. I want to touch on the Rams and specifically Todd Gurley. It's unexplainable why he did not get more touches, and I have to think, and I'll give Sean McVay the benefit of the doubt, that he was still hurt and they didn't want to publicize that, which is why he wasn't on the injury report. But I have to think he was hurt, because it's inexcusable that an MVP candidate, at least up until the last couple weeks before he got hurt, would not get touches in the Super Bowl. Why was CJ Anderson some next to nobody running back who they picked up off waivers this year playing more than Todd Gurley in a Super Bowl? Granted, Anderson has been pretty good, but Todd Gurley's all-world talent on a big contract. I mean, you pay these game changers to make game-changing plays. Inexcusable. I have to believe he was hurt, and if he wasn't hurt, this is completely on Sean McVay. There's just no excuse. Why are you putting the ball in the hands of Jared Goff, who we know is good but not great? He's not there yet. And you're putting the onus on him? Look, I had him in fantasy. He's good against the bad teams. Their offense is tremendous. But against tough teams, he struggled. Don't forget about the Bears in that regular season game. But the point is, Sean McVay really did not draw up a good game plan. He's young. Jared Goff's young. They're kind of that young, flashy offense that really scraped by a win in New Orleans. They didn't deserve to win. They got by the Cowboys, but it wasn't impressive. They basically faked their way into the Super Bowl, and they didn't execute when they were there. And I really think that the tight wins and the lucky plays masked that issue, and it was Sean McVay's play calling and the lack of usage of Tom Gurley. Look, I don't care if Todd Gurley's hurt. You pay him big bucks to make game-changing plays in the Super Bowl. If he re-aggravates a knee, that's fine. That's fine. You let him heal. You give him all the time he needs after the season. And if it's for, you know, some crazy situation where he's hurt for long term, rest him even later. But as a football player, you do not sit when you're playing in the Super Bowl. That's what every kid dreams of. So it's inexcusable, and I don't understand. But at the end of the day, Tom Brady gets his sixth ring. Bill Belichick, probably the greatest coach of all time as well. That was a masterful defensive performance that he worked on with the D-line. And frankly, I would not be surprised to see the Pats make some noise again next year, because they have tremendous coaching, and Tom Brady still got it when it counts, man. Don't let the regular season fool you. He's saving his mustard for the playoffs. And he let it fly this year. So congrats to the Patriots. After the break, stick around. I'm going to break down the Austin Matthews new contract announced today. And I'll be joined by Evan Preto to touch on that. Where the Leafs will stand in the future, specifically their contract situation into next year, and the impact of Jake Muzzin, which has been profound in just 3 games. This is The Crunch. Stick around. We'll be back on the Radio Laurier Network. And we are back on The Crunch. Folks, how you doing? It's 7:20 Eastern, 4:20 Pacific, and something 20 everywhere in the world. I'm joined by Leafs analyst Evan Preto. Evan, how you doing?
Good, Nick. Thanks. Good to be on.
Yeah, so let's talk. This was breaking news earlier in the day. Austin Matthews will be a Leaf for the next half decade, signing at an $11.6 million clip per year. What are your thoughts on the signing in terms of Austin Matthews and you know, his role on the Leafs now for the future? And what about that cap situation? We know it's going to get murky in the summer.
Yeah, for me, it was quite surprising, the fact that it's only a 5-year deal. I think this is, I'm a big Kyle Dubas supporter, and I think that this might be his first, I don't know if I want to put the word loss in there, but I'm not liking this deal too much. 4 years, anything from 1 to 4 years would have brought him right to restricted free agent status. Once it becomes a 5-year deal, he becomes a UFA. Anything larger than that. And of course, there's, with the NHL restrictions, you're capped. You can only sign up to an 8-year deal. So for Toronto fans, the home run would have been around the 7-8-year deal. But with that being said, you're of course also, you're buying free agent years from Austin Matthews. So that drives up the cap space. Earlier this week, we were looking at around 6 years was reported, and sounds like his agent came in last minute and wanted a five-year deal. The number 11.6, considering it's only a five-year deal, not too favorable for the Leafs cap situation.
Yeah, I agree. Look, it was a bit high, and when a free agent, like you mentioned, wants to get that UFA status a little earlier, he should pay a premium in terms of reduced salary, right? Because you give a little to get a little. And I was pretty surprised.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I was pretty surprised that Matthews and his agent really strong-armed Dubas here. And especially, look, I love Matthews, but there has to be, and I've been injured before, but there has to be a touch of a salary premium for being injured. And you know, he hasn't played tremendously well in the playoffs thus far. So I was surprised, not in a good way, that he had been making, he will be making anyway, more than John Tavares, who up to this point in the season has likely had a more consistent and a stronger campaign than Matthews.
For sure. And I think that speaks to a changing landscape in the NHL. For years, it was always, if you were an RFA coming out of your entry-level deal as a 21, 22, 23-year-old, the less proven stars would sign a 2 to 3 year bridge deal, like the PK Subbans and even like the players that weren't necessarily stars but were good players who contributed, you know, second to third line production. And then you'd have the higher upper echelon stars like the Jonathan Tays, the Patrick Kanes, the Steven Stamkos. They'd sign the 5 year contracts at around $5 or $6 million. And I've adjusted for cap. I calculated the other day, had Matthew signed similar contracts to what Kane and Tays and Stamkos signed when they came out of their entry-level deals, it was 5 or 6 year deals, and the percentage of cap would have equaled about $9 million in today's bid. So not necessarily a cap discount, but what you're seeing is that the NHL, when you're in your prime when you reach 23 years old. Years and years ago, you'd be in your prime when you're 28 years old. And teams aren't paying for UFAs anymore. They're paying the big bucks or going to the RFAs.
Yeah, I am with you. That is an interesting point you bring up. Guys like Tavares, I mean, I know we just signed him to a huge deal, and that probably shifted the landscape for the Leafs in the future in terms of cap space. But you're right. A lot of these big-name UFAs, by the time they're 28, 29, they're, you know, a lot of them have lost a bit of a step compared to a half decade earlier when they were 23 or 24. So that's interesting. Let's talk about the Leafs cap situation now. I believe this spells the end for Gardner 100%. And if Matthews had signed for 10.5 or 11, I would have said, yeah, there's probably still a way we can fit in Gardner. But the reason I think he is now gone is because this inadvertently sets a very high bar, and we still have to sign Mitch Marner. Look, if we sign Matthews, yep. If we signed Matthews to, say, call it 10.75, right? Because I had said 10.5 to 11. So say 10.75 for, you know, 6-7 years, X amount of years, doesn't matter. Marner's value would probably clock in the nines. But now that Matthews is up over $1 million from where I thought he was going to come in, that raises the bar for Marner, who's played really well, and he'll be commanding double digits per year. And that's going to be tough to pay. That is going to be three guys upwards, potentially, of $32 million. I struggle to see us keeping Gardner. There's just no way around it unless Marner takes a huge discount. And then guys like Kapanen and Janssen don't take, you know, premiums that would be potentially on par with what a Matthews premium would be, right? Which would Kapanen would be $3 to $4 million, probably doesn't deserve it, and Janssen could be $2 to $3 million, right? If Marner,
for sure,
yeah, if Marner gets $10+ million, I just don't see how Gardner stays. Do you have a way we can keep Gardner though?
Yeah, interestingly enough, I know. If there's been any listeners who have listened to our previous episodes, we don't necessarily see eye to eye on Jake Gardner. but we can both agree that the Leafs are better off with him on this team than they are not. you know, today's contract has certainly made that a little difficult. I was using the cap-friendly website the other day to kind of, I used Austin Matthews and Mitch Marner projections at around 11.5 for Matthews, 9 for Mitch Marner. There is a way that they could squeeze in Jake Gardner, but it is very unlikely. This would require, I mean, everything would be made a lot easier if they could just get rid of Patrick Marleau's $6.25 million to him next season.
I know.
But he's got a no movement clause. So for this sake, I'm going to keep him on the team because we can't assume that he's going to want to leave this team.
No way.
If you're looking at a way to keep Jake Gardner, you're not going to be able to field the 23-man roster. And, you know, every single game day you field 18 players, two goalies. So you have 20 dressed and usually 2 to 3 scratches. There's no way the Maple Leafs would be able to do that. They'd have to essentially carry a 20 to 21-man roster. Maybe you'd carry an extra defenseman in case of injury when you're on the road. They'd have to ship Nikita Zaitsev out of town. If they could somehow find a taker, maybe Lou Lamoriello, who seemed really keen on keeping him here for 7 years, would like him on the island.
Very true.
There's also Connor Brown on the fourth line. He's making $2.1 million. As much as I like Connor Brown, on a cap team like the Maple Leafs, you cannot have your fourth liner making $2.1 million. And then you'd also have to go to Andreas Janssen and Kasperi Kapanen, who are in for big paydays this offseason. Everybody kind of forgets that they're also RFAs. And you'd have to go to them, hey, guys, look, we need you to take the one-year bridge deal. You'll get your money the following season when Patrick Marleau, when his contract's up, and you guys will be in for significant pay raises. Because, you know, I look at the Maple Leafs cap situation, and it's only really tricky next season. Next season is when they still have Patrick Marleau, and that kind of really tightens everything up. $6 million is a lot of money. So if they can find a way to just get past next season, squeeze by, you're looking at signing Gardner at this point. You'd have to sign for 5.5. Bob McKenzie yesterday on TSN had an interesting point. We talk about the Austin Matthews contract, and you're buying UFA years from him. So that drives up the cap, the higher the term. Kind of works the other way around in my opinion, for a 28, 29-year-old heading into unrestricted free agency. The more years you sign him to, that actually lowers the AV because that player's not looking for his third. Maybe you can sign Gardner to a 7 or 8 year deal as opposed to a 5 year deal. And I know that might not look pretty at the end, but maybe you lower the AAV to a $4.5 or a $5 million, and then you can maybe squeeze them in.
Yeah, that's interesting. Someone that kind of thought process reminds me of is TJ Oshie over on the Caps, signed a 7 year deal for much less than his market value, under $6 million. So I'm with you on that front. Yeah, there's at this point, I really don't think we'll be able to move Zaitsev. I don't think he's a bad defender per se. I just don't think the value's out there for him, right? And if you look at the Leafs and you see kind of the star players and a lot of that flashy brilliance, no one thinks of a Zaitsev. And then even if you break down and watch Zaitsev, he's not overly special anyway. So the problem is, how can we offload him to a team who will then send us back decent value? And also, you'd have to presume that the team just can't take his cap hit full. I mean, they won't have the space without returning a player of similar cap hit or maybe a bit less or more. So I just don't see the value. It'll be probably impossible to trade Zaitsev. At the end of the day, Gardner's probably here for a last cup run with the Leafs, and then he'll likely be onward to somewhere else. And probably will cash in at, you know, 7 years, 40-plus million.
Yeah, I mean, you could try to do if you want to get Zaitsev, try to get creative. You go to a team with a lot of cap space. I know the Islanders next season, they do have a lot of cap space ever since Tavares kind of left them. Maybe a team like the Phoenix Coyotes, and Nikita Zaitsev is not an awfully attractive player. However, he is a right shot defenseman, and it seems like everybody's kind of looking for that these days. So maybe Dubas can capitalize on on a market inefficiency and with teams paying a premium for RFAs. But even if it takes giving up or like adding a second or third round draft pick to take the contract off our hands, I think it's something you look at. But who knows if it can be done.
Yeah, who knows? And I agree, Brown or Janssen are likely the odd men out. I'd probably say Brown just because Janssen has a little more talent. And, boy, they're similar players. Brown's maybe a little grittier. Janssen has a bit more skill. But talent-wise, I have
day.
Janssen.
You take Andreas Janssen over Connor Brown all day.
Yeah.
I mean, the guy's got – he's got plenty more skill. He's I believe – if I'm not mistaken, with the Marlies, he won the AHL's equivalent of the Conn Smythe for the best playoff performer. I know the Leafs called him up last season. He kind of replaced Leo Komarov in the lineup for Mike Babcock in the Boston series. And he, if I'm not mistaken, he contributed with a goal or a couple points here and there, but he was pretty solid.
Yeah, and I'm looking at his stats now. You know, 26 points in 46 games is pretty solid for a rookie. I mean, that's close to a 50-point clip. So, yeah, you're right. He'll probably command somewhere around $2 million. Kapanen will be around $3 million. And then by that point, Connor Brown's odd man out. And to ship him out, it'll be a tough sell for some teams. Maybe you just give him out for a late-round pick for, you know, a team in the West or maybe another team that's not our top rival. And just call it what it is. Bring up Trevor Moore to take his spot and save, you know, $1.5 million or so. I'm not sure of his contract. I think it's about $700K. So
Trevor Moore, Kyle Dubas had a nice move a couple of weeks ago. He signed him. I believe it was a 1 or 2 year deal, but the AAV is at $775,000.
Yeah, and that's a smart move. They did that with Calais Rosen a couple months ago for the same deal. I think there's 100% chance he'll have a shot at the starting roster next year because I think Dubas is already looking at, hey, Gardner's probably gone. Let's try and replace 75, 80% of his points for literally 15 to 20% of the cost. I think that's what he's doing. Let's transition into Jake Muzzin. 3 games on the Leafs, but boy, has he had a profound impact already. What are your thoughts on Jake Muzzin?
Yeah, I mean, who can't be excited? I was watching that first home game against Pittsburgh on Saturday, and the crowd kind of lit up when he laid a hit on the Pittsburgh forward. But I mean, it wasn't even a big hit, but I thought to myself, like, I couldn't remember the last time I'd seen a defenseman make a hit like that. And what I like about that hit, if you go back and look closely at the replay, Muzzin actually goes in, makes a play on the puck first, so he disrupts the play. The Pittsburgh forward wasn't able to make the play he wanted to, dump it in, and then he goes and lays the body. It's the kind of toughness this team has been lacking. I like that he brings a different element than what we don't have on their defensive core. It's a guy that he'll shoot. He's not afraid to shoot on net. And I read a scouting report a couple days after we got him by Scott Wheeler from The Athletic, and he mentioned that he just likes to throw everything on net. Doesn't matter the angle where it's coming from, and that's good because I'm a believer that when you throw something on net, even if it's not necessarily a dangerous shot, it's danger for the other team because it creates rebounds. It's danger. And, I mean, excellent on Kyle Dubas for, you know, the more I think about this trade, the more I like it. He was able to acquire a top four defenseman, and I know he's not right-handed, but I think that's kind of overstated, without giving up Rasmus Sandin, Timothy Liljegren. So neither of our top two prospects and neither of Kasperi Kapanen or Andreas Janssen off the roster. And considering that, you know, I mean, if you look at the trade, it looks like a fair value. You know, LA gets a first-round pick, two prospects. But considering that NHL teams constantly pay a premium for defensemen, I mean, it looks like a good deal for the Maple Leafs. And like I said, he just brings that different element of toughness from the back end. And he's your prototypical two-way defender.
Absolutely. I'm with you. And one other thing I noticed here last night's game against the Ducks. Did you notice the roar when he filled in Corey Perry there late in the second period? That ended up turning into a power play because Nick Ritchie went and retaliated on behalf of the teammate in an illegal fashion. I mean, the roar that was let out in the stadium when he filled in Corey Perry. It was unlike anything I've seen, except for a goal, of course, but unlike anything I've seen all year. Yeah. The Leafs are not going to be the toughest team. We're not pretending to be the toughest team. But, geez, can we at least have one threat that will make people think twice before just going in with their head down and bullying us around? I like Kadri. I like that he has a bit of an edge to him, but it's not enough. It's nice to see one defenseman who will actually make a hit, because none of the other defensemen will. I'm sure Ron Hainsey wouldn't mind to make a hit, but he just can't catch anyone, let's be fair. So,
and he can't do it effectively. I noticed, like, right, when Jake Muzzin makes a hit, he's got excellent cap control. It's calculated. It's a hit that'll work with the play. I mean, Dion Phaneuf was notorious for making the, you know, those huge, like, open ice hits. But often after that, like, the other team would, you know, they'd have a forward that would just receive the puck, and then they'd have a two-on-one behind us. But Jake Muzzin, he's just a guy that's capable. He's got the hockey knowledge. He knows when is the time and place.
Agreed. Smart player. Glad to have him on the team. Evan, thanks for stopping by and talking Matthews and some of the Leafs cap situation right now. We'll have you back in due course.
All right. It was a pleasure, Nicola. Take care.
And folks, right after the break, I'm going to break down some of these Raptors rumors swirling around. A new one out today between the Toronto Raptors and the Memphis Grizzlies. They're looking for a playoff push. Stick around on the Crunch. And we're back on the Crunch, folks. How you doing? 7:40 Eastern, 4:40 Pacific, something 40, wherever you are in the world. This is the Crunch. And just today, breaking news reported from numerous sources that Raptors GM Masai Ujiri has offered a trade to the Memphis Grizzlies. Kyle Lowry and Jonas Valanciunas straight up for Conley and Marc Gasol. And boy, is he trying to shake things up, and I think it is a terrible idea. And let me break down why. You're clearly only making this move because you don't have confidence Kawhi Leonard will sign, and you're going all in this year. However, this really ain't a big upgrade, okay? Conley over Lowry? Absolutely. Lowry has been abysmal, and I'll get to him in a second and the issue I've had with him for a little while now. But Gasol for JV? Sure, is Gasol better than JV in terms of talent, skills, stats, etc.? Veteran leadership? Sure, I'll give you that. But Gasol's pretty old. He's a little slow. And the Raptors are not a slow team. I mean, when Serge Ibaka is your center, you're likely playing small and relatively quick. His fit on this team will not be great. And granted, JV's not a fast player either, but JV has really good offensive skills on the interior, and that makes him a weapon, and you have to respect him. Frankly, I thought that he was going to win sixth man of the year, because Nick Nurse moved him to the bench starting this year, and he'd been terrific. The Raptors were 20-4 with him. They're barely above 500 since in over 30 games. I mean, this is not a JV problem. And I think Masai Ujiri has a bit of recency bias. Does he forget that JV is 13-7 in 19 minutes? Seriously, he feasts against the second unit. I don't see the reason why you'd get a Marc Gasol, who is very good. But does that mean you're going to bump Pascal Siakam out of the lineup? Or are you going to shift him to small forward and Leonard to shooting guard? And then Danny Green's out of the starting lineup. This doesn't make sense to me. I don't know why Masai would do it. Clearly, he must be a bit scared that Kawhi is going to leave and this is really a one-year chance to win. I have a bet with another analyst that I think Kawhi might stay. The odds are 10-1, so I'll get paid very handsomely should Kawhi Leonard sign a long-term deal in Toronto. However, this is very, very strange to say the least. Now, let's talk about Lowry, because I'm completely open with trading Lowry. I've had a huge issue with his attitude ever since DeMar DeRozan was traded. he remains an anomaly. And look, here's the thing. I know him and DeRozan were great friends. And I know it sucks when your friend gets traded. But can you please look at it from a macro perspective? I mean, he's being completely unreasonable. You got swept back to back by the same team. You've lost multiple straight playoff series. It's time for a bit of a change. And when a superstar like Kawhi Leonard is available, you got to take the shot. It was a tremendous trade at the time, and it remains a great trade because Leonard is a bona fide all-star starter, no debate. But Lowry's attitude has remained poor. His morale is low. He hasn't played as well. It doesn't help that he's an aging point guard and his body's not holding up like it used to be. Right? I used to play NBA 2K all the time, and when you have a guy's morale down, his skill set goes down, right? If he's rated 80 overall, but he has bad morale, his skill set will drop to 77 for that period. And I think Lowry's has dropped big time, and I don't understand why he's acting like a bit of a brat. He's still grumpy that they traded DeMar. I mean, do you like losing, Kyle? Would you rather just play basketball with all your best friends? I frankly don't understand. When you get an all-world talent like Leonard, you should be pretty happy to play with him, right? You know, the reason we all play sports is because, A, they're fun, but B, to win. And Leonard provides a real chance to win. So it is a little confusing. I think he needs to take a bit of a macro outlook. And he's just been awful this year. 31% from three. Are you kidding me? That's pathetic. So, yeah, I'm calling out Lowry, and he really needs to step up a bit. He's a leader on this team. He's been here for a while. He knows the guys. He knows the system. We'll see if his morale changes. But honestly, for the right price, I wouldn't mind shipping out Kyle Lowry. Just in terms of purely an attitude standpoint, he hasn't seemed to mesh with Leonard all that well. He hasn't played well. His morale's down. Maybe he needs to move on. Just not certain right now. But in terms of this trade, Lowry and JV for Conley and Gasol, I don't like it. I frankly just don't see how Gasol and Conley will be a better fit. Then JV, and JV is going to return this week. Nick Nurse said he's going to play on the road trip on the next couple of games. I don't know when, he didn't specify, but maybe he gets in a game or two to remind Masai that he's still a pretty good player, and he feasts offensively, especially against second units. I really think if he didn't get hurt, he would have been a six-man of the year candidate. Let's transition and talk golf here. Ricky Fowler wins the Waste Management Open by two shots, 17 under par. And look, I've been a known Ricky hater. It's not that I don't like the guy. He seems like a hoot, seems really nice. He rocks orange. He's always out there, you know, displaying affection with the fans and really working on his craft and is, you know, not cocky to say the least. Just seems like a good guy. But the hard-on by the media has been a little bit concerning. I mean, the guy hasn't won in 2 years before this weekend. And boy, you know, we know Ricky's a great player, okay? I'm not debating that. But he always seems to finish in the top five and can't win. And when Sunday comes around, he doesn't show up. And frankly, Sunday at the Waste Management Open, he didn't show up. Three over par. Did not play well, to say the least. It was a good thing he got off to a four-shot lead, which allowed him that much slack to really play poorly, because three over is not great. Brandon Grace had a pretty good round, two under, but he just couldn't catch Ricky Fowler, and he put one into the water on 17, which all but ended his title hopes. But nonetheless, I'm just going to give Ricky Fowler the credit he deserves, and what's due is due. I mean, he finally wins, and you know, he backed into a win, but he won. And these are the types of tournaments you like to win because it gives you some confidence and momentum as we get into the meat of the schedule. Got a few more tournaments on the West Coast before we move into the real big tournaments, go down to Florida, the Players Championship. And folks, the Masters is a lot sooner than you think. There's only about a half dozen tournaments until the Masters. So to bag these wins is really important and good for Ricky. He wins for a fifth time on tour if you include the Hero World Challenge. I don't, because it's an exhibition in the Bahamas. It's not even really sanctioned. So we'll see how Ricky responds from this. But frankly, I'm not going to be betting on him in the future because this wasn't one of those wins that really wowed me. When you go 3 over par on a Sunday, it'll leave me some cause for concern. Folks, that is the show. I want to thank everyone for tuning in wherever you are around the world. It's always a pleasure to be on the Radio Laurier Network and really just do what I love, talk sports and have a blast. Raptors taking on the 76ers tonight in about 10 minutes. That's going to be a really good game. JV is still out. He's not going to play in this game, so likely on the weekend we'll get to see the big fella in action before the trade deadline. That'll be a good game. I suggest everyone tune in. Until next week, 7 p.m. Eastern, I'll be back on Tuesday, 4 p.m. Pacific, and something o'clock anywhere else in the world. This is The Crunch, folks. Thanks for tuning in. I'm your host, Nick LaPenna, and until next week, this is The Crunch on the Radio Laurier Network.